One of my favorite comedians is a fellow by the name of Tim Sample, who specializes in what he calls Maine humor. Sample is a practitioner of the art of the Down East story, and this tradition goes way back, but first became popular in a wider scale back with Marshall Dodge and Bob Bryan about 50 or 60 years ago. The stories are told in a way that is gentle and friendly, but also has a little bit of wickedness to it. These stories often have a great way of poking fun at both locals and people from away. Now, Sample shares his stories on albums that he's recorded and on stage and in TV programs. And when he does it, he lays on this really thick Maine accent. Now, he's got a right to do this. He was born in Booth Bay Harbor. He still lives on the coast. And it adds something to his storytelling. If I were to share this accent with you, you would laugh at me and not with me. And indeed, some of you would take offense, thinking that I was not showing proper respect for our neighbors in the Pine Tree State. But let me assure you, when he starts deploying those ayahs, it begins to draw you into the story. Well, one gag he has is called Snappy Answers. And he begins an album called Snappy Answers with this little routine. And he observes that people from Maine are famous for their ability to deploy zingers, well-timed responses, snappy answers. And there's been a lot of theorizing about why they can do this. People have been studying the issue and coming up with all sorts of explanations. But Tim Sample has his theory. And that's because Maine natives have lots of experience answering numb questions. In this passage from Matthew, Jesus is going to offer his own snappy answer. But the question that is posed at the beginning by the chief priests and the leaders is not numb. Indeed, it is an eminently reasonable question. By what authority, Jesus, are you doing things in the temple? Jesus has just shown up. And in the verses immediately preceding today's lesson, he has overthrown the tables of the moneylenders and the courts of the temple. He has been healing the sick and lame. By what authority is he doing these things? Now, one might say anybody should be showing righteous indignation at people who are engaged in commerce at the temple. People often needed to engage in financial transactions so they could purchase things for sacrifice, but the money changing had become corrupted. Faith healing, though, that became a lot trickier. When we're sick, we go off to the doctor. But in Jesus' day, while there were people who were physicians, others often availed themselves of more supernatural courses of treatment. And sometimes this was perceived as a good thing because people working through the right channels were drawing on divine power. But other times, it was seen as a resort to the satanic, to forces that were dark. So these leaders, these teachers, wanted to know by whose authority Jesus was doing these things. A reasonable question. Now, Jesus, I believe, respected these individuals. Among these folks were the Pharisees. We all know the Pharisees, right? The villains of the New Testament, the black hats. But the reality is, the New Testament, while part of our sacred texts, part of our scripture that is holy, is also a partisan document. Matthew believed to have been one of the Jewish Christians. And this gospel was written at a time of debate and argument within the Jewish community in the middle part, in the latter part of the first century, about what direction Judaism was going to take. Would it continue along the trajectory that had been established in the diaspora, where there was still a place for temple sacrifice, but the heart and soul of the religious enterprise was rooted in the synagogue with the proclamation of and teaching of and exploration of the Torah, of the scripture? Or was it going to follow the path that was being charted by the followers of Jesus, who saw him as not only a great teacher and prophet, but as a son of God, as being divine? The irony here is that there were very important things that these two camps shared in common. Both put scripture at the center of their lives. Both spent time studying the word and exploring the word. But the interpretations they arrived at were very different. And indeed, ultimately, could not be bridged because of this fundamental existential difference around who Jesus was. But it's this shared heritage of exploring the text, of debating one another, that I believe animates Jesus' response to the Pharisees, to the priests and the leaders, when they ask him, "By whose authority are you teaching?" His response is to ask another question. He's not being a wise guy here. He's not being sassy, but he is engaging in debate. And so he asks, "By whose authority do you think John baptized?" He's taking the conversation about authority deeper. Is John baptizing with the authority of heaven or the authority of earth? All these religious leaders hear this question and, according to Matthew, immediately recognize they're in a corner. There is no good answer they can give. If they say that John was baptizing with the power of heaven, well, then that means what he was doing was legitimate. Then all those people who've been going out in the desert and repenting were on the right track. That all of the critiques of the religious establishment were valid. Their critiques of them, even if they were good and holy people, had substance. And it meant that Jesus, who had been baptized by John, was also legitimate. If they chose the other answer and they said that John's authority came from earth, well, then they were going to tick off the public. So what was their response? Well, it was a profile in a lack of courage. They punted. And it's at that moment that Jesus gives his snappy answer. "You can't answer me. I will not answer you." He's not being petulant. He's not being childish here. He's telling them they can't handle his response. Now, this may sound a little odd, but when I read this passage and I was thinking through this text, I thought of the old Jack Nicholson movie, A Few Good Men. Some of you may have seen that. You may remember there's this big courtroom scene, and I'm not going to suggest that Colonel Jessup is to be understood as some kind of Christ figure, but you may remember the big monologue where Jack Nicholson says, "The truth, you want the truth, you can't handle the truth." And that is what Jesus is saying to these people. You want to ask questions? You can't ask questions because you can't handle the answers. And yet Jesus, of course, does give an answer, because that's who Jesus is. Jesus wants the questions. Jesus welcomes the questions. Our faith is predicated on our ability to ask questions. It was that way back in Jesus' day, and it is that way today. Perhaps some of you have heard about the interview that Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, recently gave to the BBC. It was a fairly casual conversation. It's meant to be relaxed. But Welby's a smart man, so when he says things, he's thought them through beforehand. And during the conversation, he revealed to the reporter that there are times when he goes for walks. In fact, there had been one recently when he was taking his dog for a jog in the grounds at Lambeth Palace and found himself thinking about problems in the world. God, if you're there, shouldn't you be taking care of these things? And as you could imagine, this comment elicited a bit of commentary and discussion. First, who is Justin Welby to be telling God it's time for him to act? And more strikingly, what on earth is the head of the 80 million member Anglican Communion doing, publicly revealing that he has moments when he wonders whether God is there? Well, some among the faithful were just scandalized. They couldn't believe this. And then at the other end of the spectrum, there were atheists, and they thought they just won the lottery. All you need to do is read the comments section on the Guardian website or that of the New York Times. Clear evidence, they say, that religion is giving up its last gasp. If the Archbishop of Canterbury isn't sure about this stuff, clearly nobody else is. Clearly it's all a sham. Clearly nothing of the sort. Because those comments betray a deep and profound lack of understanding of what the life of faith is all about. Faith involves doubt. Faith involves regions that are shaded and hard to discern. Even if we subscribe to the ancient notion that faith is a gift from God, there are times when it is hard for us to exercise. Think about somebody giving you one of those new iPhones, the bendable model. And it comes with a set of instructions. But the people who manufacture the phone in a factory in China put in the Cantonese instructions and not the ones in English. You will have a fully functional phone. But if you don't read Chinese, you are not going to be able to activate it or use it. Faith can be like that sometimes. We have it, but we can't access it. And yes, sometimes we choose to sin or stray from God, and we choose to lay aside faith. But there are other times when, through no fault or action of our own, it's hard for us to engage in faith because of stress in our lives, or mourning, or disappointment, or loss, or pain. But we don't give up. Instead, we persist because faith isn't like a light switch that we just flip on and it's all set and ready to go. Faith is a discipline. It is a vocation. It is a way of life. We can think of Psalms, like Psalm 88, in which the author bemoans the fact that he's alone as he's being persecuted by his pursuers. Or we can think of Psalm 22, uttered by Jesus on the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? And I do not believe when Jesus utters those words, he's engaging in the exercise of a privilege restricted to the three persons of the Trinity. No. What he is doing at this pivotal moment in history is opening a door for us all, showing us what the life of faith is like. It is grounded in honesty and vulnerability. and relationship and engagement. If we are to be in relationship with God, we are to ask questions. We are not to pull punches. But we need to be prepared for God to respond. And just as we give, we need to be ready to receive. So the good news is, I don't believe God is looking to give any of us a snappy answer. But God is calling us into relationship. God is calling us to ask questions. And in doing so, we must be prepared for answers. Answers that will call us to a vocation that we did not seek. Answers that may call us to service that we don't want to engage in. Answers that may call us to travel a road we had never imagined going down. So, ask the questions. Ask away. I don't think you're going to get a snappy answer. But you and I need to be prepared to get ones that are challenging.